slip it to Chairman Duggan.
Oh, my God.
Oh, here you go.
You're the new guy, aren't you?
That's right. Anyway, Chairman Duggan is at Ann Arbor. You're just our new infrastructure chairman.
I'll take you.
Okay, we'll give it to you. The first order of business is the approval of minutes from the previous committee meeting, which has been already been distributed. Is there a motion to approve?
Second.
Motion by Commissioner Martin, second by Commissioner Bivens. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, update on the progress implementing the TPWD land and water plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things I want to report to the commission. In prior meetings, y'all had authorized the agency to proceed with the sale of our regional park headquarters in La Porte, with the understanding that we would return then move that headquarters to a new building at Sheldon Lake State Park. I just want to report that that's well underway. We're building a new facility on the north end of the lake. We hope to achieve LEED certification with that, assuming we can get some photovoltaic panels put in there that can help us do that. That would be a great accomplishment. As we talked about before, also, we are reframing the entirety of our partnership at Sheldon Lake with a partnership with National Audubon Society. They're going to be playing a very active role in a major fundraising project to help us raise about $6 million for a new visitor education and outreach center there. So we're excited about what's happening there. And being able to centralize our regional parks office led by Justin Rhodes, who you'll hear from shortly, is something we're very enthusiastic about. The infrastructure team is making a lot of headway on some major projects, and Rich is going to be giving you a much more detailed perspective on that. But just a couple of observations. One, that when we had the commission retreat, I hope that at least you had a sense of where we were with the new visitor center there at Kerr Wildlife Management Area. That's going to be a great amenity for that place. It's a major destination for landowners and others that could learn about wildlife management, particularly all the research there, and we ought to have that completed by Christmas. Also, it seems just like yesterday when we broke ground on the new facilities at the Gaylord Training Center in Hamilton County, and we are well underway there, close to 90% complete. I think Rich is going to touch on that, and so we hope to have that completed by the time we have the next class of cadets start on the 4th or 5th of January. So a lot of headway is being made on major projects with the infrastructure team, and we're real proud of their efforts. So I know Rich will be sharing more with you. So that's the sum and substance of what I wanted to report today. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Okay. Item number two, Rich McMahon. Capital programs and capital project update.
Chairman Duggan, Chairman Holtz, Commissioners, my name is Rich McMahon. I'm the Director of the Infrastructure Division. The purpose of my presentation today is to provide you with familiarization of our process and update you on our portfolio. Unlike what Mr. Smith said, I'll try not to be too detailed in that presentation. I'll do that by providing a quick primer and then an update of our portfolio. Our project delivery process, we do in six phases. And I'm going to talk just kind of in general generic terms, but this kind of focused on our bond program, which is the biggest thing that we do. Of those phases, the funding phase is the one that can be the most ponderous and the one that you probably are the hear the most about why it takes so long. After the legislature provides us the appropriation, we need the approval of numerous entities, including this commission. Sometimes that can take 6 months or better into the new fiscal year. The life of bond money is 5 years, and you see how the rest of that time lays out. What happens is, and we hear a lot about this when you look at the expenditure curve, is that it takes a long time before we really start spending money. In fact, the last 80% of the money is spent in the last 12 to 18 months of a project. Now, when we put the encumbrance over that, every time we write a contract, we actually encumber the money. And so you can see that it's really the encumbrance that comes up early, but it takes us a long time to spend money. So that whole my quick tutorial there was just to explain the 5-year cycle and why it takes us so long to spend money. Moving on to our portfolio, our current portfolio has 157 projects, $150 million. The breakout of that $150 million, 25% of that was fully expended, 18% has been encumbered but not expended. The remaining 57% is money that's allocated to projects but haven't been encumbered or expended yet. As we look across the department, 60% of that money is for projects in state parks, 38% for Fund 9 divisions, and then 2% for the headquarters. Our general obligation bond programs, our O3 bonds have been fully expended, but we've received over $600,000 in interest on those bonds, and we're going to expend all that money before the end of this calendar year. The 06 Prop 8 bonds, the life of those bonds expires next year. As you can see, we're well on our way to fully expending those, and I don't anticipate any problems doing so. Our 9 and 10 bonds, I'll talk about over the next few slides.
Before you move on, the interest concern in the 03 bonds, are we free to spend that anyway as a commission?
No, sir. Those bonds are to be used for the purpose of the
project.
Right. So we're using those in right now, probably in 2 headquarters projects. The 80th legislature in 07 provided us $69 million in bond funding. Of that, of course, $25 million went to the Battleship Texas. We tried a different project delivery method in that rather than dealing with each project individually, we bundled the package projects together in 3 geographic packages. And the purpose of that was to encumber the money faster, to gain staff efficiencies, and especially if there are remote sites where we have troubles getting good quality contractors and by packaging in this, that way we got a contractor who had to take the good places along with the bad.
How does that work?
It has accomplished those 3 things, Chairman. One of the things we did not necessarily get the big companies that we thought we were going to get, but we've got quality contractors. We've also learned some lessons that we'll apply in our next bonds about how to do it more efficiently. For example, we organized them just geographically the first time, and I think we're going to break it out functionally as well, because we have some engineering projects that we really need to put architects on. So I think we've learned a lot, and we'll be even more efficient in our 10 projects.
But it is the right way to go. Just you got to keep fine-tuning it like any process.
Yes, sir. I think that we're in agreement that it's the way to go, and again, we've learned lessons that are going to make it even more efficient as we move forward.
So, I mean, it's a state requirement. We're doing by law. They're doing by law in the books, but they're trying to find ways to do this in the law. It takes much to build a bathroom in a park as it does to build a 100-meter highway. It would be relative to the process.
And I'll show that a little bit, at least how we set up the encumbrance procedure a little bit later. So 2/3 of those projects we did in the packages. 17 of the projects were done with our internal construction teams, and then 16 projects were done independently of what we call one-off projects. When we look at the timeline, it took a long time to get funding. It took almost 12 months into the fiscal year before we had funding. We then hired our architectural engineering firms in December of 08 to begin design, and we are scheduled to begin construction in December of 09, so a year later. As you can see, when I overlay that expenditure curve back on here, you can see that we're right on the brink of really beginning to encumber a large portion of the money. So December, January, and February, we work through the contracts with the contract managers at risk to encumber that money and then expend it through the construction phase. We're scheduled to finish November of 2011, and then that money expires in summer of 2012. Moving on to the FY10 general obligation bond program, which is what the legislature, this last legislature, authorized. We have $38 million in bond broken up into two different categories, as you can see there. The schedule, you may remember that in August in Fort Worth, you approved these lists. We've now sent those lists to the LDB. We're waiting for their approval. In case we'll make those gates down at the bottom to really begin design in the summer of 2010 for completion of construction in the summer of 2013. And that first group, the statewide capital repairs, is $28 million. Again, the same timeline, and our breakout of those projects are 68% for state parks, 25% for the Fund 9 divisions, and 7% for the headquarters here. In the second group, which was the weather-related repairs, the legislature told us specifically to do projects to repair damages by flooding at these three locations. Again, they're on the same timeline. What I'd like to do is take the opportunity now to talk a little bit about Mother Neff, which you can see is receiving considerable money. Mother Neff State Park, 259 acres. It's on the Leon River, just west of Moody, Texas. It was a CCC park. It was built by the CCC in the 30s. In 1954, Belton Dam was built, creating Belton Lake. And the problem with that is that the normal level of Belton Lake is 594 feet. The lowlands in the park are just about 600 feet. So you can see how the lake looks there. This is what happens. 5-year flood is 604 feet. All of the CCC structures are at an elevation of about 612 feet, the three CCC structures as well as the camping. Then you look at the 10-year flood, we're almost getting our stuff wet. And then the 25-year flood, we begin to take on water at the CCP structures. Now, the 10-year flood level is kind of a misnomer because of the artificiality is that there's a dam downstream that catches that water and floods the water. So in a dry year, 2 to 3 times a year, and in a wet year, 4 to 6 times, the water rises to that 25-year flood level. And so there will get mud and debris and flooding in the park for 1 to 2, up to 5 days each of those times. They'll have water, standing water in the park. And as we move on to the 50-year flood level and then the 100-year flood level, you can see that in the summer of 2007, we exceeded the 100-year flood by a foot, which also put the CCC structure, at least based on 15 feet underwater. And of course, because there was a lot of water downstream as well, the dam was forced to hold that water for about 3 months. So for 3 months, the result was the tabernacle, which is the stone structure on the upper left in this slide, looked like it did in the bottom picture there. On the right is the recreation hall. You can see by the water marks that that's actually after the water has started to recede. That summer, the water was held by the dam. There was water in the park for 3 months. This is a quite a mess. Our way ahead, we originally looked at thinking about moving those structures. And I'm not, at this point, I don't believe that's going to be possible. Instead, what we'll do, we're going to create a new master plan, and we've begun that planning process. We'll do a structural assessment of those CCC structures and look for opportunity to repair them and shore them up. But more importantly, we're going to relocate the permanent facilities up to the high ground, and that will include a camping loop with full RV hookups. Mother Neff was one of the first state parks, and we are talking about our goal is going to be that it will be the first state park with zero net energy consumption. So the goal in properly using the resources in that area. The 81st legislature also provided us supplemental appropriation to deal with the damages caused by Hurricane Ike in September of 2008. $2 million of that was directly for CREM, and then $12 million was for Ike repairs in general. You see how we broke out that money. The majority of that money was to go to Galveston Island. Almost $4 million to go to three wildlife management areas where we repair levees and water control structures, and we're also going to repair the roof at Sea Center in Texas. So let me talk about first about Galveston Island. Galveston Island State Park is a little over 2,000 acres on the west end of Galveston Island. As you can tell from the photographs, since the park was built in the 70s, there's quite a bit of density on each side of the park. The park has both beach access and bay access. I'm talking to Justin this morning, who continued to comment about what a heavily used park this is. When the hurricane came ashore the evening of 12-13 September 2008, not only was the island of Galveston devastated, but so was the state park. The picture on the right, that's the former park headquarters that has since been demolished. The supplemental appropriation came with a two-year lifespan. And when we found out that was the way that the appropriation was going to work, we made the decision to, rather than asking for all of the money, we asked for money just to do the planning and design, and then once we have that design, we go back to the legislature and ask for appropriations to do the construction. Therefore, it is our plan to conduct master planning and design, and then to expend, although we believe the appropriation requires just encumbrance, but we'll expend that money within the two-year life. The request for qualification for the designers has gone out, and we receive them closes at the end of this month, and we plan to begin design in February 10. We look at this as an opportunity to redesign, rebuild a very important part in our system, and it can become a premier part in our system due to the density and use not only in Galveston area, but in Houston area as well. And likewise, we want this to be a model of resource conservation. Moving on to CREM, which is outlined in yellow there, CREM State Park is 4,141 acres of marshland. There's also 5.2 miles of coast or Gulf Beach. As you can see, it is backed up by J.D. Murphy, WMA, and it is just to the west. See, it's the right picture there, just to the west of Sabine Pass. This park was also devastated. The picture on the left is looking from the Gulf inland, of course, it's marshland behind the park, although that certainly looks like a bay. And on the right is the former, well, I guess it's the current park that we're sitting. Again, same timeline involved with 2 year life of the money. Well, for CREM, we plan on doing the design and construction during that 2 years. CREM was hit in 2005. By Hurricane Rita. We had just finished repairs but had yet to reopen when Hurricane Ike hit. We've been undecided what to do with the park, but with the legislature giving us this money, we've determined to reopen the park as a state park for public use, primarily as a minimally developed park, but it will be both day and overnight capability. Finally, I'll talk about the Dan Warden Training Center. As Mr. Smith said, we were 80% done on or completed in construction. I don't have much more to add to that. As he said, we're scheduled to be completed in time for Colonel Flores' next class in January of 2010. Just thought I'd show you a couple of pictures. On the left is the original condition of the the administration building, and that's what it looked like at the beginning of last month on the right, and then the lecture hall. So we encountered some rain delays, but we are on schedule to finish up in January, on time for this class. That completes my presentation. Any questions?
Mark.
How are we on the fundraising for the airport?
Let me start with this, of course, is just phase one part.
Right.
And we have about $150,000 left over in phase one, which Tom Flores has asked us to use to build the front gate and to build one of the residences. As far as the phase two funding, I don't have that information.
I'd say on that front, Commissioner, we still have, you know, very realistically another $10 million that we need to raise to complete the second phase of this, the aquatic training facility, the firing range, some other buildings on site. I think most of you are aware we had a very generous contribution from Governor Clements. We celebrated in Dallas a $2 million gift to help facilitate this. The timing hasn't been great given the economic climate. Continue to express the foundation as our absolute high priority from a fundraising perspective, but we can certainly benefit from some additional discussion with all of you about additional prospects that may be able to help us. I think we've made a lot of headway. We have a lot to show for the resources that we put into it, and I think if we do it right, we can use it as a springboard to raise that second part of it. Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Item three, update on the San Jacinto Battleground on the State Historic Site, Battleship, Texas.
Commissioners, again, my name is Rich McMondo. I'm the Director of the Infrastructure Division. I'll be joined for this item by Justin Bowes, who is the Director of State Parks Region 4, and also Jeff Kester, who is the Program Manager for Infrastructure in Region 2, which includes State Parks Region 4.
Thanks, Rich. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Again, I'm Justin Rose, State Parks Division, Region 4 Director. I'm going to start this out. I want to pass around to you guys all to take a look at it. Gosh, we need to pass around out here as long as we promise to get it back when we're done. But that button is actually from the San Jacinto site if it was recovered. And it's believed to be a button off of an enlisted man's uniform from the Mexican Army. And the significance of that is, you guys know who are familiar with the story, the day after the battle, April 22nd, 1836, Santa Ana was captured. When he was captured, he was wearing an enlisted man's uniform, disguised in that uniform. Obviously, the disguise did not work that well, and that ultimately led to not only our independence in Texas, but the United States acquiring over 1 million acres of land and making the United States a five-coastal nation. In 1883, Texas saw the significance of this site and set aside our first public land acquisition of 10 acres. In 1907, San Jacinto became the first Texas state park. In 1936, we began work on the San Jacinto Monument, that was a public works administration project. And 3 years later, we had in Texas the tallest monument in the world, and it still is known as the tallest monument, freestanding monument in the world today. In 1838, we formed the San Jacinto Museum of History Association to help operate the museum and take care of the monument. They're still going today. Each year on the 21st, we remember and honor and celebrate that day, and we do it on the steps of the monument. We have local leaders come out, as well as Sam Houston's great grandson, Sam Houston IV. The following Saturday, we have the reenactment and festival, which is a huge event for the community of Houston, which aimed to draw 20 to 30,000 participants. Archaeology continues to tell the story out of San Jacinto, and some of the recent work, which was funded through Parks and Wildlife and friends of San Jacinto, helped us discover, if you look at number 6 down there, the what we believe to be a formal surrender site of the Mexican Army. Through advanced metal detecting and instruments to exactly GPS and coordinate where these artifacts are, again, it continues to unravel pieces of the battle and tell us things we have not previously known. In interpreting the battle and protecting the site and the resource, one of the challenges we have in that area is subsidence. This map right here is from 1906 to present time. The San Jacinto site has subsided over 10 feet, and that's primarily due to industrial groundwater pumping. And being familiar with the battle, you guys know the Mexican armies retreated through the marshes to the north, to the east, but what they retreated through, this shot here is from 1995, are now lakes. And in 1995, Parks and Wildlife began a marsh restoration effort where we were pumping drainage material in there, and it was very successful. And through continued work and replanting, we have what we believe to be conditions as where the soldiers approved. And just another before and after shot, the one on the left is a photo from 95. And again, we focused on the North Marsh. We have yet to tackle the one to the east, but you can see the photo recently taken on the right. Again, that upper right-hand corner is the marsh area. You can see the green area in there now. It's again back to the true marsh. Not only is the site significant for historical content, but it's also an escape for Houstonians to get out. We're being surrounded by industry and petrochemical industry. It's a 1,200 acre green space, and people routinely come out there, bring the family ships to get outdoors. Battleship Texas is also a part of our site. It was commissioned in 1914 and is the only remaining Dreadnought style battleship left in the world. It fought in both World Wars I and II. It was buried at our site in 1948. When visitors come aboard the ship, we don't want them just to walk through and see an empty ship. We want them to feel as if the sailors have just stepped away. And working with our INE shop here in Austin, we've been able to develop some exhibits to bring the ship to life. Cafeteria, for example, has food that you really cannot tell a difference if you walk around and see this food sitting on the table. It really makes you feel that we're getting ready to serve a meal. Same thing in the canteen. Again, we want the visitors to feel that they're on a living ship, and the sailors have been just stepped to the side. We have several partner groups and support groups at the site. Our three formal partner groups with formal MOUs, and one being the San Jacinto Historical Advisory Board, which is governor appointed. We also have several stakeholder groups that assist us from leading tours on the battleship to archaeology work to prairie restoration. You know, it's hard for us to not operate without these assistance. And with that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Jeff Gasper. He's going to get more into the upcoming master plan and the design concepts we have going. Thank you. Any questions before? Thank you.
Opportunity to share a little bit about the project at San Jacinto with you. Director, my name is Jeff Kester, and our focus today will be on two of the major projects at the site, the Visitor Center and Battleship Texas. Before we discuss these two projects, I'd like to share some of the recent history of the site. Due to the site's size and nature of the historic site, the battleground, the monument, the battleship. This park is one of our busiest in terms of ongoing capital repair and development projects. In 2003, we spent $476,000 restoring the exterior stone cladding of the monument. In 2005, $2 million was spent for fire protection, waterline replacement, and elevator upgrade of the monument. In 2006, we repaired the battleship Texas monopods. Those are the things that anchor that ship in its berth so it doesn't float away in the storms. In 2009, $33,000 was spent on replacement of one of the two semi-ton chillers from Montgomery. Currently, we're working on a $4 million visitor center, jointly funded by TxDOT, Parks and Wildlife, and its partners. $1 million replacement of wastewater lines and lift stations throughout the park, funded by the 0809 Capital Bond Program. And finally, the $29 million Battleship Texas Tri-Berth project, funded with $25 million from the 0809 Capital Bond. $4 million from the Battleship Texas Foundation. Finally, in the future, we plan to initiate a new waterline project to replace old waterline that were built in the 1960s and a reconstruction of seawall facing the Houston Ship Channel. And finally, there are plans to replace or to build a 1945 barrel wharf after the dry berth is completed sometime in the future. As with all of our park sites and other sites in our agency, there are a lot of unmet needs, unfunded needs out there that need to be addressed at some point. Same is true here, even to a greater extent. The needs of Tenya Center can be broken down as follows. There's 700 unfunded needs in the battleground totaling about $21 million. 5 unfunded needs in the monument totaling $734,000. And 6 unfunded needs in the battleship totaling $27 million for a grand total of about $49 million worth of development capital repair needs in the site. Some of these were generated by the master plan showing restoration of the battleground for $12.5 million and other major development projects. The master plan was developed in 1998. It described a vision for restoration of the battlefield, which provided for a visitor center and outlined the need for the interpretation of the battle. Soon thereafter, TBG Partners was hired to more fully develop the master plan, and they produced what was called a schematic design package in 2005. The TBG documents developed after meetings with stakeholders delivered to us the battlefield restoration design and budget, development of the visitor center concept, recommendations for interpretation of the battle of the museum and the battleship, and a plan to consolidate all the service facilities in one location, out of sight, and away from the battlefield. Right now, they're currently visible with everybody driving up for the first time at that site. One of the hurdles that we have to clear in order to go forward is our resource clearances, which we're currently engaged in right now. They're required of all capital projects in our agency. Most projects only need an internal natural and cultural resources review, which our staff performs for us, and it takes just a few months. On other projects, if wetlands are impacted, Parks and Wildlife must obtain a 404 permit from the U.S. Corps of Engineers. The process can take from 6 to 12 months. In projects like the Visitor Center and Battleship Texas Driver, federal reviews are triggered by virtue of the fact that we're using federal funds in these projects. This means these projects must be reviewed and approved in accordance with Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, and also conformed to the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which requires us to perform this environmental assessment. This can take 2 to 3 years to complete this Section 106 EA. If the EA determines that adverse impact is going to occur on the site, then we have to elevate it to the environmental impact statement, which can take 5 or 4 years. These are the complications that we're looking at at this site for our projects undergoing the federal funds and federal clearances. At this time, there's opposition to the visitor center by one of the stakeholders, and as a recognized consulting party, it's telling TxDOT that this project will significantly adversely impact the site. The Parks and Wildlife has answered and rebutted the concerns, but the opposing stakeholder is asking TxDOT to elevate the review of the EA to the environmental impact statement. If their boss, the Federal Highway Administration, rules in their favor, according to TxDOT, TPWD could plan on spending more than $1 million in addressing SBIS and expend hoping that it's not elementary GIS as our project in this.
Who makes the determination whether or not it's elevated to each other or GIS?
Federal Highway Administration, which is the lead agency, they're providing funding for us through TxDOT. As a part of the EA process, we're looking at five alternative sites, potential sites for our visitor center. They're chosen based on recommendations from the master plan, the TPT schematic design package, and stakeholder input. As a part of the EA, archaeological investigations have been completed at each of these sites. And currently, each site is now being evaluated under a number of criteria to ascertain which site best meets the need and purpose of the visitor center and have the least impact on the natural cultural resources. Shown here is one of the presentation boards displayed at the May 12th public meeting that was held in Houston area in Fort Detrick. And specifically shows the site, alternative sites A and B, shows the building placement and also the parking placement. And the green overlay shows wetlands that are impacted by these sites. For the environmental assessment, the architects prepared design for the visitor center fits unique qualities of each of the five different sites. We have to understand designs like these five sites, parking impacts are, and so on, for effective analysis. And whatever size of the visitor center is going to do this, it's going to be the first point of arrival for the visitor at the site. It will provide restroom facilities and refreshments for visitors, provide store purchase retail items and tickets for the different venues at the site, and also offer the visitor an orientation to the site. Interpretation of 1846 battle, interpretation of Abbotsford, Texas, and its role in playing the national force. So it has a very valuable function in terms of the visitor coming to the site. Finally, this slide will go away in 9 seconds. It's on a timer, unfortunately. This is the schedule. It just shows that by September 14th, we hope to close this project. The reason the length of time is so long between now and then is because the environmental clearances we're going to go through. And every step of the way, TxDOT must review our planning process. So it's back and forth, months involved in all the different reviews go back and forth in the design phase. We hope to kick off the bidding construction phase by the end of 2011. So that's all I've got. I'd be happy to answer your questions you have before we pass over to Rich.
Just a transition off, bring home with the future. As I mentioned in my last presentation, the 80th legislature provided us with $25 million in bond funding for a project to Blackbird in Abbotsford, Texas. In the summer of 2008, we prepared as part of the requirements for that funding the project plan for the Blackbird Image Battleship Test. I'll talk a little bit about that. This slide shows some of the depictions of the possible concepts of what the Blackbird would look like. We have not chosen a concept or a plan to go with. That's what we're leaving up to a design company to come to us. Gives you an idea of some of the potential concepts. And last time the ship was in dry dock for repairs was 1988 to 1990, and these pictures kind of give you a picture, give you a vision of both the size of the ship as well as what it looks like below the water lines. Is the paper that we dried out the last time. Our schedule is in July of this year, we received funding. We have out right now the request for qualification for the design firm that has closed, and we plan to begin design in January of next year. We foresee about a year for in the ideal world, we see about a year for clearances, 12 months for design, 18 months for construction, in the fall of 2013. Or clearances could take 2 years and move it back to the fall of 14. Or as Jeff talked about, we could get Bob County clearances and it could extend the timeline considerably. One of the things, however, is that if the visitor center goes to require an environmental impact statement, we'll look to combine that with the clearances that we need for the township. We'll be able to clean those up so that they won't go sequentially. We'll save ourselves some time and some headache there. As Jeff mentioned, you may have heard the total before, $27 million in other projects for the battleship. This comes from our project plan, but I'm not sure how accurate these numbers are going to be. Once we put the ship in driver, some of these things may not be required. For example, replacing steel, hull plating, we may be able to find a better solution so that the ship won't be sitting in the water. So these numbers are just numbers that were developed in 2008, but once we get the ship up into the driver, we'll be able to get a better assessment of what the needs for the ship will be. As far as other projects in the area, the picture on the left is the seawall that is southwest or just below the slip there that the battleship is in. That seawall is deteriorating, and we have requested a $2.6 million grant from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program from the Department of the Interior. The great thing is this is a no-match grant, and so with that $2.6 million, we'll be able to fix 1,100 of the 1,600 feet of that seawall. Unrelated to our request of that grant is the fact that we'll be looking for a place to put the battleship when construction goes on in the driver. And an ideal location would be one where we continue to provide access to the public, and one that seawall may very well be the place that is chosen to do that. And finally, purely driven by the Battleship Texas Foundation is the desire and the need for 1945 era wharf that would be alongside the dry berthing of the ship. Those are artist rendering. We're still working on the design of probably much more elevated due to the flooding that we encountered and learned about during the hurricane. The wharf would be completely funded by the Battleship Texas Foundation, but we would not even be able to begin work on this until after the dry berthing is complete. That completes our presentation, and any questions from the commissioners.
Questions, comments? Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Item 4, Hurricane Ike, Natural Resource Status for the Jim Sutherland, Thanks, Rob.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Lance Robinson. I'm Regional Director for Coastal Fisheries on the Upper Coast, Mexico Coast. And we've been asked to give you a briefing on some of the impacts of Hurricane Ike on natural resources in that area last year. And I'll turn it over to Jim to start the presentation.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Sutherland. I'm Project Leader in Region 4 of the Wildlife Division for the Upper Coast of the Wildlife The wildlife management areas that I'm going to talk about this afternoon are the Murphy area in Jefferson County, Four Nations Wildlife Management Area in Orange County, and Candy Ashore Wildlife Management Area on the opposite of the Dayton Chambers County. Here's a picture of this blue maze. You can see Candy Ashore, just a little green dot on the spinform in Chambers County. The picture on your left is right after Ike. Candy XRWMA had approximately 31 acres of heavy debris from Bolivar washed across the bay onto the island. It also lost about 4.5 acres of shoreline on the bay side on September 13, 2008. And the picture in March 2009 is after TxDOT and their contract to clean up the debris from the storm. Did a really good job cleaning up for us. Spent close to $600,000 removing debris from the area. Here's the Hawk Watch Tower on the site, debris around it. And almost finished up in March. The site was reopened to the public on the 1st of April in 2009. Over in Jefferson County in the Murphy area, we had close to 140 acres of debris and wetlands. Presented a much bigger problem to us as far as access to get debris off the area. You can see the amphibious equipment we used under textile contracts, money provided to us through the governor's office to clean the debris up in these coastal counties. This amphibious equipment was utilized to drag the debris out on small barges out of the marsh to our waterfronts. It was separated there and hauled off by truck. Quite an operation, cost just under $1 million to clean up the Murphy area. And again, by May, these guys were cleaned up and gone. Tremendous effort. The picture, the March picture on your right here, is a little grappler barge that was used in Keith Lake. And that debris and that low boy trailer actually are debris from the storm. That little boy was quite a boat track out in the lake. It was right out in the middle of Keith Lake after the storm. In addition, we burnt close to 7,000 acres of prescribed fire on Murphy area to rejuvenate our marshes after the storm because of all the salt impacts, the crashes. And TxDOT also cleaned close to 5 miles of our ditches and our wetland impoundments that were silted in from the storms on Murphy area. This is an aerial photo, two aerial photos, one from 2006 on the left, one from 2009 on the right. What I want to show you where that one is, just to the right of the one in the 2006 photo, is a little round lake called Line Lake. Line Lake's about 360 acres historically. If you look to the photo in 2009, Line Lake's about 1,400 acres. That occurred on the 13th of September. That scour in March from Hurricane Ike. The next photo, show you a little bit closer up, that's the marsh above the Johnson and Keith Lake in the Salt Valley Unit of the Murphy area. And if you look above the shoreline of the lakes, just above the tube, you can see where the grass is scoured out in the 2009 photo into several new open flats. And that's the kind of emergent marsh impact we had from the storm. And I'm going to turn this thing over to Lance now. He's going to tell you about some of the recovery money we got to do some restoration work in this area.
As most of you know, hurricanes are natural events, and they've been impacting coastal habitat for thousands of years. And fishery resources specifically are pretty resilient to the impact of those storms. Not so much so for humans, and certainly this picture that you see here in front of you kind of depicts one of the issues that we still are having some challenges with, and that is access for recreational fishermen to the water, to the resources that are out there. The picture on the left is a post-Ike photograph of the Texas City Dyke. Infrastructure down in kind of the lower part of the picture there is a boat ramp that actually was one of the top three busiest boat ramps in the state of Texas. Hundreds of trailers on the weekend would show up there fishermen and watch, and that access point has not come back into operation even until today. Other resources that were certainly impacted were those that couldn't move in advance of the storm surge. We had significant impacts to oyster habitat throughout Galveston Bay, more so in the East Bay area, the area that the commission closed at the August meeting to allow some restoration to occur over there and recovery of that resource. What you see on the images here are results of some side scan sonar surveys that we've conducted both pre and post hurricane Ike. You'll see the polygons that are drawn around the oyster habitat in the top picture and what it looks like right after the storm. About 83% of that oyster reef in that area, in that particular image, was silted over by sediment. Not all of the impacts from the hurricane were so negative. There were some positive effects. This particular shot is, again, some side scan imagery from pre and post Ike. If you still look in the top left-hand corner, you see the picture of Galveston Bay in the small little square. That's the area that we are focusing in on. The Houston Ship Channel is labeled in the bottom left-hand corner to kind of give you a reference. What we see happening here is that the storm surge, the 10, 15 feet of water that came into Galveston Bay, came in, and then it exited the bay. It funneled out right around the Houston Ship Channel, and that fast retreat of that water removed sediment over the top of some of the reef, that reef complex there. It also scoured the sediment and removed sediment from the edges. And the picture on the right, which was taken after the storm, the side scan image was taken after the storm, actually that reef is elevated another foot above the surrounding bay bottom simply because the sediment was scoured and flushed out of Galveston Bay. That's a benefit. It puts removes sediment off the top of the reef, which will allow oyster larvae to settle. It also raises that reef up higher in the water column relative to the surrounding bay, which makes oysters and other filtering animals there make food more available to them. There were some restoration projects that the department had conducted prior to Hurricane Ike, but I'm happy to say that those projects came through pretty well. The picture on the right that you see is a debris field along the North Deer Island breakwater in Galveston Bay. That breakwater was originally designed to serve as a wave attenuation or abatement of wave energy in the marsh. And it was not designed certainly for the force wave energy generated from a hurricane the size of Ike, but it was afforded some protection from the standpoint that that area was 10 feet underwater, so we didn't have that wave energy pounding into that. What I'd like to do now is shift a little bit and talk about some of the projects and some of the work that somebody has started and will continue over the next year or so. The picture that you see on the right is a picture in the J.D. Murphy area. Out in the background, that open water habitat that you see there was a result of scour from the hurricane. And the department received a $7 million grant from Fisheries Disaster Grant from NOAA, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Some of that money, $1.5 million of that funding, will be used to restore that open water, kind of return it to what the habitat looks like in the foreground of that picture. Another $500,000, making up that $2 million there, and the NOAA fisher will be spent on restoring some of the beach ridge at the McFadden National Wildlife Refuge. The storm surge reached the beach ridge, and so we have, even in high tides, we have ocean water moving over into these marshes and burning the vegetation there. There's also a $5 million restoration in the Lower Neches Wildlife Management Area. The funding is coming from the Corps of Engineers at the request, or sponsored by the Port of Orange. The funding is for dredging of navigational channels, and they'll be working with doing some restoration work at that wildlife management area. Additionally, there is a $6 million project in West Galveston Bay. $5 million of that money, a little over $5 million, was funded by the American Restoration, the stimulus dollars, the Restoration Recovery Act funds, and some additional matching funds will be used to restore about 300 acres in West Galveston Bay. Some work that took place in late August and early September was some oyster restoration projects. The picture on the right of the East Bay restoration project was an effort to restore some of that lost habitat from Hurricane Ike, and is now in that closed area, allowing that habitat or that restoration project to actually recruit oysters and let them grow and develop without being commercially harvested. The photo in the bottom right kind of shows what the barges, we took nine barges like that and created about 20 acres of oyster habitat, about 12,000 cubic yards of material. The North Shore Restoration Project is a much smaller effort, but it's kind of a unique project. We restored 2 acres of oyster, small oyster habitat, small pads. It's a collaborative effort funded by a grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service through the the Fish and Wildlife Service funded it. We're also getting some assistance from the Galveston Bay Foundation and local property owners. We worked with the local community. Several had interest in kind of restoring some of the oyster habitat there, and so we worked with them to strategically place these small oyster pads in locations where they will not be accessible to any commercial activity. And then upcoming, in addition to the $2 million from the fishery disaster funding that we received from NOAA, we also have a little over $3 million that we'll be using for oyster habitat restoration. This is some preliminary information that some work will be contracted with Texas A&M and Galveston to assess the depth of the sediment over these reefs that were impacted by the storm. And we'll use these maps, these images, to kind of guide our restoration efforts. The goal being to get the maximum bang for our buck. What you see in this image, what it's showing, is that light yellow-colored area is the area of a reef, and this is about a 1,700-acre reef. The yellow area represents habitat that is silted over with about 6 inches or less of sediment. Those would be the prime areas that we would want to focus on as we get to utilize more of the cultured material spread over a larger area. Plus, we're also planning to utilize the commercial industry in having them pull bagless dredges over these shallow sediment areas and turn the shell back up, allowing that hard substrate to have some exposure for juvenile larvae to settle on it and then grow. And so kind of in conclusion, you heard a little bit about Galveston Island State Park. Here's a couple of images showing the right immediately after the storm, the visitors facility and the temporary facility that's in place now that allows this park to function and operate. Another interesting shot is of the campgrounds on the beach side. Put this in here, kind of give you an idea that there is some restoration even in habitat. You can see the vegetation is coming back, beginning to kind of come back to the way it was prior to the storm. And with that, I will close and certainly entertain any questions that you have.
Questions or comments?
First time. He doesn't know. We're okay.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to comment on this. I don't want to just get lost in it. That is an extraordinary effort in terms of the restoration, in terms of what our team on the upper coast has fronted in terms of the damages and the impacts. I mean, not only to the properties and resources that's good, but to their personal properties and families. How quickly they took years in working on conservation and restoration. I mean, really, it's an extraordinary story. You love to have accomplished in a very short time. Starting to see that in terms of people getting out and using the resources is a wonderful, wonderful milestone in the agency, the people that represent us on the other coast. I don't want that to get lost here at the end of the day. It's really important work for them.
But it's going to be in their memory. Then Katrina, and then Rita, and then Ike. I mean, so that whole lot probably been great year after year, like 3 or 4 years. So thank you. I appreciate it, President. I'm immediately headed back to the West Coast.
Yes, sir. I ask that we have Rich make a report at the January meeting on the battleship Texas, the status of the situation, given that apparently we're waiting on the federal government to determine whether we go to that.
Go to the EIS or not?
Yeah. I think it's important to the, I mean, the legislature is decreed that we get this project done. I think we're doing as much as we can do. I think it's helpful for this commission to know on an ongoing basis where we are so that we do what we can to fulfill that mandate from our legislature.
Absolutely. We'll just plan on reporting back to you in January and there on after regularly on.
Please.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. I declare us adjourned.